It's the Bob Edwards Show on Sirius XM Public Radio. I'm talking to Margaret Hawkins, and her book is After Schizophrenia, The Story of My Sister's Reawakening After 30 Years. It's an intimate portrayal of a family's struggle to cope with a commonly misunderstood disease. Hawkins describes her sister's irrational fears of going outside, even just going into the basement, something her sister Barb won't do until this day. In 1980, in an attempt to learn about the illness, Margaret read a book which she decided not to share with her parents.
This is the book in which I learned the word schizophrenogenic mother. And it's by Silvano Ariety, and I think it won the National Book Award that year. And it's it's an excellent book, and it was state-of-the-art science at the time. But it still placed blame on the parents. And it was a revelation to me. This is where I first saw this statistic. 1 in 100 people in any given population is likely to be schizophrenic. But I didn't want to show it to them because it still maintained that position that psychiatrists held then, that parents were culpable. And they were having a hard enough time. It didn't, it wouldn't have helped them. It would only have made them angrier.
How long did your sister live with your parents?
After she came home, obviously she was independent for a while, but after she came home at the age of 30, she's lived there ever since. And my mom died in 1996, and my dad died in 2006. So she's been there since then.
Throughout the book, you express doubt and wonder about how the family handled Barb. Is it common to want to hide someone like that because of the stigma?
Yeah, I think it is. I think it was. And, to their credit, that they didn't only try to hide her. They were trying to protect her. They were trying to help her and keep her somewhere. And she didn't want to leave the house. It isn't as if she wanted to go out, and they prevented that. They enabled her fear by protecting her, possibly too much, you could say. They didn't know what to do, and it just became a way of life that she withdrew from people, which is a typical behavior on the part of schizophrenics. I mean, I've taught many people come out to me now after this. People at the drugstore start talking to me about it. Everybody, it's kind of wonderful that people feel they can talk about it. But they'll say, there was this person I loved so much when I was a child, and I tried to go visit her in the hospital where she is, and she didn't want to see me. And it's sad, but it tends to be the case that people with this disease are in their own world, and it's very hard for them to interact with other people. And so, yes, she was in the house, and yes, they kept her there, and yes, they were disinclined to talk about it, but she also wanted to be there apart from the world.
When your mother died, the doctors said there wasn't really anything wrong with her, that she just essentially starved herself.
Yeah, my mom was very depressed, I think, at that point. She was young, I think, but she was in her 70s, but she was tired, and she was sad, and she just decided she was going to stop eating, and she did. So she had a very strong will, and she was able to accomplish that.
Your father gave you custody of Barb, which was a huge responsibility.
Yes, he did. I write about that in the book, and it is a huge responsibility. And at the time, I had always anticipated this. And when it happened, though, it was, when we actually went to court and went through the legal process of having my name added, there was still this moment of, realization of just what this would mean. Or maybe not realization. I didn't know what it would mean. I didn't know it would have such a happy outcome. But certainly it was a very big responsibility to anticipate.
As your father neared the end, you needed to bring in outside help. At the time, the nurses were happy to help, but scared of Barb. Tell me about that.
Yeah, that was That was tricky, both right before he died and then afterward when I was just getting caregivers to come in to kind of watch her while I was, you know, otherwise I would have had to have moved in. And the nurses were afraid of her, you know, because, again, because of this stigma surrounding this disease, which has this scary name, you know, schizophrenia. It sounds like a saw, you know, cutting through glass or something. I mean, it's just a terrible stigmatized word. And so people were a little afraid of her. And, I mean, it always takes me a while to remember that people will respond that way because she is so, you know, she's a very gentle person and very gracious. And now that she's better, her personality has emerged somewhat, and it's quite obvious to anybody who meets her now.
Was she a threat to strangers at the time the nurses were afraid of her?
No, she's never been a threat to anyone. No, she's, you know, if you could meet her, Bob, you'd see she's very petite, and she's very, she has this exquisite politeness about her. No, she's certainly not a threat.
There are photographs in the book, and you see such a stark change between the young bride to the elder Barb in 2008, and there are not many photos in between.
Yeah, well, and not many were taken. There were some that were taken, but as always, as you know, when you write something about your life and about the lives, about someone else's life that you're very close to, and who you're their historian. I didn't want to just put pictures in just to, you know, provide shocking information. I certainly wouldn't want somebody to do that. If I had this experience, I would not want somebody to include terrible pictures of me. Please, anybody out there who might write a book about me, so that was my thought. I didn't want to just put in pictures of her just to be dramatic.
Your father died just before Christmas 2006, and on New Year's Day 2007, you're alone with Barb. What was that like for you?
Well, it was terrifying. I was really scared. It's, you know, looking back now, I see that it was this very dark time, you know, and in Chicago, I mean that literally as well as psychologically and spiritually. But I also see that how rich it was in possibility. And I don't mean to sound like a Pollyanna, but it really was. You know, it was this dark moment where I just didn't know what to do. And I was teaching then, and I was on semester break. And so I would go over there every day. And I had left a regular job, and I was expecting to be doing more freelance work than I was doing, so I had time on my hands. So I would just go over there every day, and I was clearing my father's things out of the house and visiting her. And it was just, I started to get to know Barb in a way that I hadn't had the opportunity to do over many, many years when my dad was there, because he was very much the center of attention when I would visit. And now it was just the two of us. And so as dark as that time was, it was also kind of exciting. We started to talk. She started to talk to me.
Did you ever consider moving into the family home?
Well, only in brief passing. I mean, I have my own home and I have my own life. And, you know, if my circumstances had been different, I might have. But that would have meant an upheaval in my life that I was not prepared to make.
You attended a meeting, a support group for schizophrenics and their family members, and that was the first time you heard anyone talk about being schizophrenic.
Wow. That was an incredible experience. I will never forget that. There were this was organized by this wonderful woman whose name is Wendy Trafney, who was a social worker who came to the house. She did outreach, you know, which is a very rare thing these days. The time, you know, time and money don't allow it that often. But she came to the house and met with me and met with Barb. And she was the one who found the psychiatrist who helped us. And she organized this meeting. It was like a monthly meeting. And so she invited me and I went. And there were these men who were members, you know, part of this agency that she works with, works for, and they were mentally ill people who were members of this, and who stood up and spoke about their condition. And they told these stories. It was heartbreaking, and yet both because they were so painful and because of how brave these men were and what they had lived with and wrestled with and, you know, what they struggled with every day. And they had jobs, and they had one of these guys, you know, had a girlfriend, he had an apartment, he was this very handsome, well-dressed man. I mean, it was so moving to me to think that these people had this condition that my sister had, and that they had, with help, they had found a place in the world. And I thought, you know, why can't my sister have that too?
So that gave you hope?
Sure it did. It did. All of these people gave me hope. You know, and I wished I could have, like, time traveled and, you know, given this to my parents, because they lived without this. But sure, it sure gave me hope.
Was she still having rants at that point?
You know, I forget exactly the timing. By this time, she was on medication, and so she was, that was beginning to subside, because, you know, she responded immediately to the medication, within days. So by that time, you know, that was only a couple of months after she had started taking it. But she was clearly better, but she was still experiencing some of that.
When she did that, it was, so much of it was focused on violence and rape. Why do you think that is?
I don't know. I've asked many people, and it's, and all kinds of, you know, like, she talks about, like, military attacks, too, is another subject. You know, and you could, you know, part of me says, well, gee, open the newspaper on any given day, turn on the television, and this is exactly the information that's being sent out into the world. And maybe, you know, maybe her mind has a way of picking up on these things in a, with a sensitivity that, you know, some people might say is, you know, kind of a, some sort of, you know, psychic ability, and other people would say, oh, that's, people would say that's a lot of hooey. I don't know. But I have come to the conclusion that she was not reporting on real experiences, because she does not talk about those things anymore. But it gives rise to all kinds of questions about, you know, what is in the mind, and why do these rants all come to people with this disease? Because they all have startlingly similar stories that they tell, or things that they hear from the voices. You know, why do they all hear these same things? Why don't they hear different things? It's quite mysterious to me.
So you're able to get her some medical treatment. Tell me about that process.
Well, that was astonishing. That was just incredible. This wonderful social worker found a psychiatrist that she, I mean, someone she worked with at her agency, who was willing to come to the house. Now, this had been a fantasy of mine for decades, that I would find somebody who would come to the house. But it wasn't possible when my dad was alive, because by this time he was so angry and suspicious. He had sworn off on the possibility. So as soon as he died, I started trying to find someone. And Wendy found Dr. Weinstein. And this wonderful guy who, when she told him that Barb wouldn't come in to see him, he said, well, I guess I'll have to go there. And, you know, just the most pragmatic and humane response you can imagine, and that's what we needed. So on one terribly wintry day, you know, he pulled up to the house. I just couldn't believe it. It was like living some kind of a dream, and I had canceled my class that afternoon, and I lit a fire in the fireplace, and there I was, and I reminded Barb, and I was terrified she would withdraw when she found out what was happening, and she didn't look happy about it, but she stayed downstairs. I was afraid she'd go upstairs and slam the door. And he came in and he met with us, and he was so kind and so respectful and so the opposite of everything my parents had feared. You know, it was like he was a suitor, you know, or something, or someone who politely wished to speak with her, and she can be kind of imperious sometimes, and she granted him that favor. And after they talked for a while, she went into the kitchen. She was always offering people grapes in those days. So she went in to get a plate of grapes to pass around. And while she was out of the room, he turned to me and said, "Well, your sister is, I would diagnose her as paranoid schizophrenic. And it would be great if you could bring her in to see me." And so I explained again, you know, well, she hasn't left the house in 30 plus years. And then this was my one shot, this way, one shot in a lifetime. So I said, "But would you consider prescribing something now?" And he kind of looked down, like he said, "Well, I didn't even bring my prescription pad into the house." And then he put on his coat, he walked through a snowdrift back out to his car, came back in the house with his prescription pad, wrote this tiny little prescription for 0.25 milligram of an antipsychotic, and handed it to me. And I filled it that afternoon. She took a pill that night, willingly, and she was better within a week.
Hmm. And therapy too?
No. There has been no talk therapy. But Wendy was coming every week then. And so in a sense, I mean, you know, Wendy and I would hang out and talk. And whatever we talked about, she would listen to. And after a while, she started to join in a little. And at first it was just subtle, and then it was more, you know, assertive. And pretty soon it was just, you know, us hanging out. And then the nurse would come over, and then I started inviting my friends over, and it was like a salon.
So you were making baby steps with your sister, huh?
Yes, hmm. Yes.
How is she today?
She's great. Thank you for asking. She's great. I was over there on Sunday. I usually go on Sundays, and I take sandwiches in the New York Times, and we sit around. And she's, you know, she leaves the house now to go out into the backyard. She won't get in my car. That's the next step. That's a big, big step. I always, you know, we walk out to my car, and we look in it, and then I always have a lot of stuff in my car. So I, you know, I say, you know, "You want this? Do you want this?" There are always books that she wants. And so I'm thinking one day, and then I say, after I clear the seat, I say, "Would you like to get in and go for a ride? You know, I think maybe we'll go somewhere for, you know, a bite to eat or something, or just drive around and look at the changing leaves." And so far she hasn't accepted, but my hope is that someday soon she will.
So you're still seeing improvement?
Oh, yeah. That, you know, it's odd because I didn't know that the drugs work that way. I thought it was that they clear this eclipsing effect that the disease has over the personality, and then, you know, that there's a plateau and they stay there. But in my sister's case, for some reason, she continues to get better. So she's having more memory, she's more competent, she's more independent. So it's mysterious. And, you know, it's just so wonderfully hopeful to me that somebody in their 60s is having this renaissance of personality and an appetite for life. That's, you know, after being so ill for decades, it's really hopeful to me, for all of us, that somebody can reawaken at this stage of life.
Thank you much.
Thank you.
Writer Margaret Hawkins, her most recent book is After Schizophrenia, The Story of My Sister's Reawakening After 30 Years. Next, the beliefs of a roller derby skater.